This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us this week to discuss the people, stories, and events affecting the tri-state are City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Later in the show, Northern Kentucky Tribune managing editor Mark Hansel will join us for a discussion of the news from Kentucky. You can join us this afternoon, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sharon, Pat, and Jay, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be here.
Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley gave his State of the City address this week, Jay. So what is the State of the City? What did he have to say?
Well, I'll let Sherry weigh in, too, but I think he was pretty upbeat, there was some news made. He kind of reviewed the last year, talked a lot about neighborhood investments and some of the things that have happened since he gave the speech in 2015. I think probably if the newsiest thing that I thought was the fact that he's going to bring back the independent collaborative monitor, Saul Green, to do an update on the collaborative agreement.
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, the last thing we expected him to talk about was the collaborative agreement. And then there was that, you know, you say collaborative agreement, and everybody was like, wow, that was, I mean, so that's kind of caught the audience off guard. It's not what you expected.
Yeah, you know, people always point to that and say how successful it's been for Cincinnati. So why does he want, why does he feel a need to revisit it at this point?
I don't think he's questioning the success. I think he's just saying that, you know, it's been, and it, I had to stop and think, but it has been 14 years since it was implemented back in 2002. And there have been quite a few changes. And I know one that he pointed to was the fact now that police officers are already or soon will be wearing body cameras, and how to the fine line that the city has to walk there about transparency and releasing those, but also the fact that police officers are wearing body cameras in and now could infringe on some people's privacy when they're wearing those cameras into their homes.
How likely is this to happen? I mean, he's talking about actually bringing back Saul Green.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly when the city was released from the monitoring, but it's probably maybe been like 2008.
Oh, six. I think it was either six or eight. The years kind of fly by.
They do. But essentially, he's being, you know, brought back in. They'll do an audit. He's, you know, review what has happened and then make recommendations. One of those could be like on body cameras. One thing I think is interesting, I heard on our air this morning, where the Columbus Police Union and the city had agreed to some standards for body cameras there that actually the officers in Columbus will now be able to review body camera footage before they make a statement or talk about a situation, which I don't think that was
the case.
That's not the case here. So that could be one of those things that comes up in this review of the collaborative agreement.
You know, I do think it's very likely to happen. Council's going to have to vote on it. It's going to cost something. And we don't know what yet, but I think council would have a tough time saying, no, I don't think we should take a look at that. And so I think this is basically a done deal without it being a done deal yet.
What did the mayor have to say about the issue of crime during his State of the City speech?
You know what? Crime really is down. I mean, we had like a period last year where we saw violent crime up, shootings up, and I think that
it was a very bad stretch. Yeah.
And it, you know what? With the under the new police chief, and you can't always just say one person's, you know, responsible, but we've really seen, you know, a decline in crime, and no mayor is giving the State of the City if crime is down and not saying crime is down. So he seized right on that.
Well, he's also pointing, I think, to the fact, too, that he's had more help with enforcing gun laws in the city.
Yes. So they have some help from the feds. You know, he also talked about Spot Shotter, which hasn't gotten a lot of play, but it is one of the premier crime-fighting techniques in this country. Big technology, Denver has it. He went out to Denver to take a look at it. That's real-time shooting, and you have technology that's like, oh, that shooting happened right there, and police can go. And so we'll see that in hotspot neighborhoods. It's part of the surplus spending. So they still have to approve that, but that looks to be happening.
A couple of other things I thought was interesting is the fact that if all goes as planned, Prosecutor Joe Dieters and the city together are going to ask for the creation of a housing court. They've always had like a housing docket, but I believe a housing court would set up a full-time judge to handle nothing but housing issues, and that could be directed at some of the landlords that have had repeated problems with their properties. Columbus and Cleveland already have housing courts, and Mayor Cranley said that with his working collaboratively with Prosecutor Joe Dieters, they've improved trust that they could bring one of those housing courts to Hamilton County. And I know it's hard to believe that there's distrust between the city and Hamilton County.
No.
But that was like an undercurrent of the state of the city, where there is starting to be some collaboration, and it wasn't like a theme of the state of the city. But you heard it, I think, more than one time, and so it's tiny steps, but it's coming along, and housing court is a big step towards that. This county needs a criminal housing court, like for felonies.
What about in terms of poverty? What did he have to say about strides made against poverty in the Cincinnati?
I think he said childhood poverty was down, I want to say 5% in the last 2 years. And then he also has I don't remember the official name of it, but it's a task force that's studying it. I think Vice Mayor Mann is involved with that, too. And they're supposed to have some recommendations soon on, I think the goal is to reduce it by 10,000 in 5 years. I'm going off the top of my head there. But there's an ambitious goal, and there's some recommendations on how to do that. I think they're going to be coming out soon.
And he said that last year, the 10,000, and that got a lot of attention last year. That's a bold goal and very tough to do. And he doubled down on it. Like, that didn't just fall into the air and it's never happening. He said it again on Tuesday, so he must feel like that's really a priority.
How's he feel about economic growth in the city? But what did he have to say about that?
1,200
new jobs, and I think the number of residential building permits has increased, and the amount of I'm going off the top of my head. I should have brought the speech with me. There was some numbers that I think each of the last 3 years in terms of commercial building permits had increased significantly compared to where they were to the pre-recession times.
So, I mean, we did hear very rosy numbers. It was the state of the city. But we didn't hear underlying numbers. Like, I'm still left with questions like, what were the poverty numbers that they used to get to the 5%? I'm left with, well, did we lose some jobs, too? Of course, like, 1,200, that's a number I 100% believe. But it's like, well, what were jobs to start? What are they now? And so there were some lingering questions without underlying numbers.
What did he have to say about the heroin crisis?
You know, this year's been a big year for heroin at City Hall. Yeah. It's the first time we really have heard, like, plans and people taking action. And he went over kind of what the city's doing about it.
And I was going to say, I think the number was, 37 naloxone, 3,700 doses of Narcan or naloxone that have been given out by the city's fire department so far this year.
And, of course, I have to ask, he was an opponent of the streetcar system, so I'm wondering if he had much to say about the streetcar during this speech.
Actually, it was the first time I think he was and I had to go back, but I think he was actually, without being too overtly cheerleading for the streetcar, he praised city officials for bringing it in on time and under budget, and was glad that it's now operating.
So I guess his position is now that it's going, he wants to see it succeed.
I think that's what even some diehard opponents to the streetcar, you know, once it's here, they don't want it absolute
failure. They use it a way to talk about urban core revitalization too, right? So it's an easy springboard to, you know, pat themselves on the back for another reason as well as just getting the streetcar project done.
And I think, I mean, if we sum up the speech, I think this year's State of the City was a lot of policy. Next year, I think, I won't say it'll be overtly more about politics, but with if the speech is given in the same time frame, it would be about a month before the election. So I would assume that, you know, next year we're going to hear as much as he can, a little bit more about politics, and here's why I should have a second term of the city's mayor.
We did see Yvette Simpson, not directly that night, but she, you know, released kind of a response. She didn't have a lot of her own ideas, but she talked about, you know, wanting to see bigger ideas. And so Yvette Simpson's running for mayor. Mm-hmm. And so she did put out her own statement after the state of the city.
What were some of the ideas she put out there, Sharon?
She just talked about wanting a bigger and vision for the city without saying what hers was, which I'm sure we'll hear about on the campaign trail. But she, you know, was looking for that, like, some big idea, which I would say that the ideas that he talked about are realistic. You know, like, I think it would be hard to say, I'm going to do this whole huge whatever in the state of the city, since that takes a lot of collaboration within City Hall.
Let's talk about the streetcars since we started to touch on this. Pat, if I'm counting right, this weekend will be
a month
mm-hmm. since it started its operations. Any idea at this point how many people have ridden the streetcar?
Well, Sherry, you said the most recent numbers you got were about 140.
146 from September 9th, the first day of operation, through October 4th were numbers they put out last night.
So we're saying 146,000.
Yes.
Rides.
146,000.
Which includes the opening weekend that saw about 50,000.
How much is this?
And those were all free.
How much is this exceeding their expectations? I guess they have to be looking
significantly.
Say, wow, this is pretty amazing.
It's been a busy September. There's been a lot going on downtown and on the riverfront. So that's kind of what we're seeing play out this week, right? Is they almost can't keep up with the demand for this, and it's causing some delays. People waiting at stops, and there's no room for them to get on a streetcar because it's so full. So that's what led the city and Harry Black, the city manager, to reach out to the transit authority and say, "Hey, we need you to keep up with the schedule that you promised," which they have gone to their contractor and said, "You need to run the schedule that you promised," which is about 15 minutes every during the weekends and about 12-minute headways during the week.
Yeah, that's so they call that headway, the time
that's
between
right.
the waiting time at a streetcar station. And that's a contractual thing, right, Sherry? I mean, they have to achieve that number.
It is, and the language couldn't be more clear. Even a non-lawyer could read it, and it's like they have to meet this obligation. But there are other things in the contract that, you know, brought things into question, like, well, you only gave us this much money to operate, and, you know, there's a special events clause. And
right.
so that was discussed all week on what really needed to be done. And then last night, we finally saw a promise from Transdev, the streetcar operator, to say, we're going to run more cars on the weekends.
And of course, I'm supposed to ask questions, but I'm going to
ahead, Jay.
But what it seems to me is that, and maybe this is the cynic in me, that was just a too simple solution. And maybe, you know, okay, we're going to promise to run more cars on the weekend. But at some point, I would think that if they're going to run extra cars, it's going to cost money. And somehow they're going to want to be reimbursed for that.
But it does seem like the riders, at least we saw this on Oktoberfest, right? So there was so many more riders, but then they were able to prove it out with the ridership numbers that the people who rode it covered the cost of running more streetcars. And so, you know, they actually do have 6 months to work out the data and kind of make adjustments. But at this point, the riders are certainly making up for the running more cars. And so I think that's kind of the thought there.
I just wonder, too, at some point, if we're not going to see maybe, and I think they talked about this in a transportation committee, where there could be like a seasonal schedule where it runs one set of times from like April through October, and then the rest of the year it's on a different schedule to meet ridership demands.
Well, it's like with the ticketing machines. You can't really see the problems that are going to crop up until you're up and running. It's you know, these kind of growing pains. I've never heard of a transit system that got up and running without them. To your point about the passengers, the increased demand for ridership, the kind of flip side of that coin is that because you're operating it more, it's also just going to keep costing more. It's kind of like this loop, right, where you increase capacity, which costs money, and then demand increases, and then you have to increase capacity again. So it can be kind of a feedback loop in that sense as far as cost.
I do know the council, because we've heard them talk about this several times now, council's main concern is, for a lot of people, these are their first streetcar rides, and they don't want people to walk away upset.
With a bad taste.
So they understand that you know, you have to collect more data. They understand that, oh, in 6 months, we'll kind of know more. But they're concerned about the impression that people are walking away from, because they want it to be successful later and people to come back down and ride it a second time to Findlay Market. And so that's, you hear that in City Hall. I mean, I'm for sure we're going to talk about this during Transportation Committee on Tuesday.
I'm sure it's coming up to Tuesday.
And Pat, speaking of growing pains when you're first getting started here, they had kind of an odd incident occur. I think it was Tuesday, where one of the streetcars actually escaped from the
rolled right out of the station.
They rolled right out.
Yeah, they were performing maintenance that required them to disengage the brake, I'm not sure what they expected to happen when they disengaged the brake.
Somehow I don't think it was rolling out of the building.
I don't think they had that in mind either, Jay.
But yeah, it escaped the maintenance and operations facility on Henry Street and rolled out. I think it stopped right in front of Rheingeist because that's right next door. I think that's where it ended up.
Around the bend. Yep. Honestly, it is a big deal. Nobody was hurt, thank goodness, but somebody could have been back there. There could have been cars back there. But, you know, something that's kind of come to my attention through this happening is there is an investigation going on. But in Ohio, rail investigations are not public record unless the Department of Transportation decides they're public record. So, normally in City Hall, I would say, well, we'll have an investigation. We'll, you know, see it through public records. I'm not sure that's the case on this one. And I really do hope they, you know, want to explain what happened eventually.
And something else interesting that happened in relation to the streetcar this week, John Dietrich, the gentleman who oversaw the project and has overseen quite a few projects in Cincinnati, was told, at the end of this year, you're finished. We don't need you around.
Yeah, the city manager delivered a letter to him. I think it was dated October the 4th, which I thought was kind of ironic because it was the same day that the mayor was praising John Dietrich for helping to bring the project in on time and under budget. And that same day, he got a letter from Harry Black saying that his employment as the project executive will end on December 31st. And between now and then, he's to help transition to the folks his knowledge about the project and get things closed out. And I think, I don't know if John's comment to the Inquirer, but I saw it, I think, in the Business Courier, was he expected it, but he didn't expect it to be this soon.
That was really the takeaway. I'll tell you what. So when you write about City Hall, you know, there's people who love to comment on stories, and half the people like it and half the people don't. Universally, I have seen this week, people love John Dietrich. It's just overwhelming praise for the work he's done, for the person he is. I mean, people are really sad to see him go.
Well, he's led so many projects, the banks and Fort Washington Way. And he's been successful when he's done it, streetcar.
And he was sort of, I mean, there's no way around it. He was brought in to salvage the project. I mean, that might be a little strong, but I mean, it was running into It was running into budget problems, and they needed someone to guide the ship to reassure folks that this thing wasn't going to keep increasing in cost. And clearly, when he came in, it came in, I think the surplus, the last report was about $3 million to the good rather than being over budget.
It's been no easy task. On top of, you know, building a streetcar, he's had to deal with City Hall politics, and he's done it well, and it was not easy.
And I would think it would also have to be somewhat of a blow to those who are hoping for future phases, at least temporarily, because they need, I know there's some streetcar folks on Twitter saying, you know, we really need him if we're going to go forward with
the talk of expansion.
The second phase of this project. And I think people can talk about it, but I think any realistic talk about a second phase is going to wait until after next year's mayoral election.
That seems most likely.
And then after that, after some planning.
Yeah.
What does this, in terms of the streetcar's future, Sharon, how does this affect it?
Well, you know, he really did. He finished up his work. He did what he needed to do. He had a partner, Chris Eilerman, and who worked for the city before the project. John was hired specifically for the project. But, you know, Chris was a longtime city employee. He's now partnered with John for 3 years, and he'll stay on. So it's not like the streetcar is having no oversight. And there's talk of even creating, like, a liaison job. But John Dietrich had the fourth highest salary in the city. Like, the liaison job for the streetcar to Sorta is not the fourth highest paid person in the city.
On another topic, Duke Energy and the city, they fought in the past about who pays to relocate Duke's utilities for the streetcar project. And I think in that case, the city ended up... city lost that one. And the city is now intervening with the PUCO about Duke's plans for its natural gas pipeline. And this week, There was a new dispute that popped up. And what's this?
And part of me wonders that right now it doesn't appear that the city and Duke get along very well. They don't like to play nice.
No.
Essentially what has gone on, and according to a city memo for decades, for critical facilities in the city like the Metropolitan Sewer District plants and waterwork facilities and Lunkin Airport, there's a primary electric feed from Duke to these facilities, but then there's also a switch and a backup feed so that if for some reason they lose power on the primary circuit, it automatically switches to a backup circuit. And the city says that this has happened for years, for decades, with no charge. Well, last November, Duke notified the city that they were going to start charging, basically it's a backup rider fee for this backup power. And the city manager says that could add about $1 million a year to the city's electric bills.
They use that much backup power?
Well, it's just the fact that it's available.
Okay.
And apparently they were trying to negotiate a lower rate. Those negotiations were unsuccessful. So now the city has filed a lawsuit through the PUCO trying to object to that backup fee. And so that the PUCO will ultimately decide if what the fee is and if it's acceptable. And the PUCO does allow it. I guess the city's argument, I think PUCO allowed it back in 2009. So if they've been allowed to do it since 2009, why did they decide in November of 2015 that they wanted to start charging it?
But right now this is in the courts, and we'll just have to see.
It said it was filed with the PUCO, which kind of – they called it a lawsuit, but it was filed with the PUCO. So technically that's not a court. So I'm assuming that it's something that the Utilities Commission decides. Okay. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Something else interesting, too. We had a vote at City Hall this week, or maybe it was not quite a vote in reality, but we had a move to have City Council approve Indigenous Peoples Day and use that to replace Columbus Day. So what exactly happened here, Sharon?
You know, this is really a movement across the country. I mean, Denver did it this week, and there's other – it's been kind of, you know, an undercurrent since 1977, and cities are kind of moving away from calling Columbus Day Columbus because of the history that, you know, we're now knowing and maybe didn't grow up, you know, learning in elementary school. And it's in some places controversial, and for sure, I mean, we just saw an outpouring of people who didn't want to see a change or did want to see a change. And – This seemed like something the city council was going to do. Like, we heard about it in committee, it passed out of committee, and then we saw full council not take a position on it, which, honestly, it's something I've never seen. There were 5 abstentions.
Now, that was the unusual thing. You had 4 people say, yes, we definitely want this. And then you had 5 people say, we're abstaining.
I mean, people were really shocked that this didn't pass. And, you know, without a lot of comment. Like, normally, council members like to explain themselves, right, Jay?
A lot.
Yeah, I'm very curious about this, Sharon, as to why they would have just abstained as opposed to saying yes or no.
Well, Yvette Simpson, again, mayoral candidate, she put forward this idea, and you know, there's been some suggestion that the underlying politics played a role here. Mayor Cranley, of course, he said, I have no position on this, so. It's not something that would be, you know, out there of what happened. But, you know, some people are blaming politics.
And the only council member that did express a reason for his abstain vote was council member Winburn. And basically, I think I'll get this right. Basically, his point was, if you want to do this, just pick a different day and make it Indigenous Peoples Day. But let's don't change Columbus Day. And that was – he thought that if they did that –
Yeah, he thought his comment would have been unanimous if they had put
that
out.
But that didn't happen.
Doesn't that seem to defeat the purpose of the supporters of this idea?
Probably somewhat.
I mean, they were very upset. I mean, you saw a group of people on the verge of tears. It was hard to watch.
Mm-hmm. And I guess looking back, if we had – normally they vote each – week, a different council member goes first in the voting. In this particular week, it happened to be Vice Mayor Mann. And when he was, I think he was the first vote and he abstained, that probably spelled trouble because if they didn't, I think they needed the 5 Democrats for this to pass. And obviously they didn't have David Mann's vote.
So does this come up again, do you think, Sharon?
Well, Yvette said, you know, there's work to be done. And it was, you know, really put together a lot of years worth of research by the Human Relations Commission, and they said they're not giving up. So, but, you know, that's going to mean like going around and rallying support, and I don't know how well that's going to go.
And just to be clear, some folks may say, well, geez, if it had four yes votes and five
you
people
abstained. You only needed one more, yeah.
Well, no, it had four yes and five people chose not to take a position, but council rules say for something to pass, it has to have a majority vote.
Has to have five.
Which has to, it has to have five. So if it had five and four abstentions, then it would have passed. But the way that it passed this way, it didn't have a majority.
There was stunned silence in council chambers after the vote, and then, you know, people had to ask the city solicitor, did it pass? And then more stunned silence. And then the answer, no.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten to this story? I mean, have you gotten a lot of people have a lot of people been interested in it?
You know, it found a national audience, really. I mean, it's the top story of the week at the Inquirer. It was other than the Accused podcast, which if you haven't listened to that yet, you should totally do that.
Yes.
But for a news story, and especially
Amber Hunt and Amanda Rossman.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, just absolutely amazing true crime story. But, you know, for a City Hall story, it just really people were interested in it. And, you know, some people were saying this is, you know, political correctness run amok. And other people are like, you know, it's time to make a change. And it was really these polar opposites. And I think that it made it find an audience.
Sharon, we got the results this week of the Ohio Attorney General's review of a now defunct foundation that the Metropolitan Sewer District had set up. It was called Project Rebuild. And what did the AG have to say on that?
You know, he came out, he was really looking at this. This is something that my coworker Dan Horn and I kind of found when we were looking at the Metropolitan Sewer District, a lot of records and going through things. And, you know, we found that they had this charity where contractors for the city actually gave money to the foundation. And then it was used for like internships and, you know, it had a purpose. And, you know, the AG's been looking at it for several months, and then he just came out and he said, you know what? He's like, I find no wrongdoing with this. And he was very, you know, he wanted to put that out there and let people know that.
Well, I think he found no wrongdoing in terms of charity law, correct?
Yes.
Now, why did it come under review in the first place?
Well, with contractors giving money to it, mm-hmm. and, you know, and it raised some eyebrows because it was like, it was actual Metropolitan Sewer District employees were on its board, and you didn't really know a lot about it, and so it raised some eyebrows when it kind of came to light that this was happening.
And are there any investigations of Project Rebuild that are still going on at this point?
Well, the state auditor is doing a whole look at the Metropolitan Sewer District. This has been going on for many months. It's not complete. I'm not even sure it's going to be complete by the end of the year from what I'm hearing. This is a deep dive look at everything having to do with the Metropolitan Sewer District. And so I'm sure because it's a state, you know, entity, probably work in tandem with the AG and not try and duplicate that work. But there's still a lot of things being looked at.
Well, Sharon, Pat, and Jay, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Pat's going to join us in the next part of the show, along with Mark Hansel from the Northern Kentucky Tribune. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me now as we review the news of the week from Northern Kentucky, Northern Kentucky Tribune Managing Editor Mark Hansel and WCPO.com reporter Pat LaFleur. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mark, good to see you, and Pat, good to see you again.
So, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Kentucky's highly touted healthcare exchange, Connect. I mean, this is something that a lot of people pointed to and said, this is a model of success. Other states should emulate this. It's going away. What happened here?
Well, I think that Governor Bevin had kind of identified this when he was elected as something that he wanted to do, and he's been working towards for several months. And, you know, he just got the okay that everything's in order and they can make the switch. It has been touted as a model, and I know a lot of people are disappointed, including Governor Bevin's predecessor, former Governor Steve Beshear.
He had such a big role in right. forming this exchange, yeah.
But at the same time, it's going to make it very difficult because there is a very short window now for people to transition.
So as far as the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services approving this, that they had reservations about doing this, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That, you know, and some of those reservations had to do with the short window. I think as I recall, you have to be is it November 1st?
Yeah, that's when the next round of signups starts.
Right, and then I think by December 15th, you have to be signed up to be eligible by January 1st. You can actually sign up until January 31st. So that is going to make it difficult. You know, people are going to have to look at, you know, what alternatives there are. And it's always a challenge. You know, even when you have health care, it's always a challenge when you have employer-funded health care. And when you have something like this, it's even more challenging.
Bevin's pointing them toward the national program, right?
That's right. Yeah, I think that is where this is going to go from here.
So healthcare.gov.
Healthcare.gov.
As opposed to the does it surprise you that this is happening?
Me personally, no, because, you know, love him or hate him, and I think a lot of people have been on both sides of that coin. Yeah. with Governor Bevin. He is pretty determined to do what he said he was going to do, and as long as, you know, the law doesn't get in the way, I think he's followed through on that. So I kind of expected this to happen.
He was pretty clear about it from his campaign, even in 2014 and 2015. I'm sure for him it comes down to cost, and he's very fiscally minded, and I'm not surprised by it at all.
No, I think they pointed to, you know, as much, maybe $11 million, most of that will be transition costs for this program. And the you know, the KYNECT, or I can never say that.
KYNECT.
But yeah, it was certainly much more expensive. So.
And you're right. That's how they spell it. It's KYNECT, but it's KYNECT is how they spell it. But they pronounce it KYNECT.
You think I'd know that by now.
Yeah. But does this is that it? It's done? Is there any wiggle room on this, or any chances this could ever come back?
I would say not under this governor. I mean, you know, maybe Governor Governor how quickly we forget.
Steve Beshear.
Steve Beshear. I'm sorry, you were right. Yeah, you know, he certainly has that Save Kentucky Healthcare, which is a nonprofit he founded, and I know that's, you know, he would like to see it come back. But, you know, I think this might be it, for better or worse. And you know, there certainly Forbes wrote an article recently pointing out that, you know, there are a lot of reasons why, you know, you should go to healthcare.gov. So I'm sure there's a lot of arguments on the other side as well. But
I find the timing interesting. I mean, I know it fits with Bevin's arrival, but we're also facing a number of pretty big health crises in our region here, but also throughout the state of Kentucky as a whole. Perennially has health problems higher rates than the rest of the nation. So, especially given the heroin crisis that, you know, has been underway for the last several years. A health policy move like this is interesting.
And I think it goes back to that political divide that, you know, certainly Andy Beshear and Matt Bevin, you know, our Kentucky's Attorney General, Steve's son, they're just, you know, there's this infighting that continues to go on, and it goes to, you know, the Obamacare thing. Certainly, you know, there's always been that argument, well, Obamacare didn't cause the health care problems in our nation, but then the other side, people say, well, it certainly didn't fix them either, and you can look at that both ways. So for the most part, healthcare has become catastrophic injury care. If you really want to cash in on your healthcare, get a catastrophic illness, because with $3,000 deductibles and things like that, it's most people are paying for most of the healthcare anyway out of their pocket, so.
How likely is this to become a political issue when Bevin runs for re-election, or will it have been long forgotten by that point?
I guess it depends on, you know, what happens, how it works. And Bevin's a funny cat. He's, you know, he ran without the support of a lot of people, even in his party, and he won. So now it's kind of hard after he's won to say, you know what? You got to toe the line. He said, why? I got elected doing this. And there's another guy who's kind of looking at that on a larger scale. So we'll see how that works out.
Well, and the Kentucky's General Assembly has been shifting toward the right over the last several election cycles, too, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's huge. It very well could happen that this year the Republicans take control of, you know, both houses and with a Republican governor. And there's, you know, we're going to be doing some things on election night that'll be keeping a very strong eye on that. Certainly if the House goes Republican, you know.
And hasn't Senator Mitch McConnell been pushing for this whole idea of let's make the General Assembly as Republican as we possibly can?
Absolutely, you know, and he's not alone in that. Certainly, you know, there's always an argument it's good to have some balance, and I think a lot of people feel that way, but it very well could happen. A lot of people think it will, so.
But as far as Connect goes, people who've been using that system need to be prepared for a pretty big change coming up on November 1st.
They really do, and the argument that I made, you know, off the air, I think is somewhat valid. You know, it's kind of like when somebody tells you they're going to tear down your house, you don't wait till the wrecking ball is out in front to start looking for a new place to live. And I think it's been that way with Connect. People have known, you know, for a while that this was likely going to happen. And, you know, while it's certainly a concern, I think people should have been preparing for it all along. So.
Now, a different topic here, Mark. The Northern Kentucky Tribune has filed an objection to Northern Kentucky University's request for a judge to issue a gag order and seal records for a Jane Doe lawsuit. First off, what's the suit about?
Well, the suit has to do with a Jane Doe, obviously, a female student at the university who alleged rape in a campus dorm back in 2013. And her concerns with the way it was handled, some might say covered up, and the idea to gag or seal the records in the case, you know, we feel like the public has a right to know that, you know, what's going on, what the arguments are, how officials are arguing this case. Some people feel that the university is protecting their student athletes and others on campus, and
the university might actually say that we're trying to protect the identities of those involved for good reasons.
And there's something called FERPA, which is the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, which protects the rights of students' identities and issues like this. And that's what their argument is and their contention, and it's a fair one. You know that certainly you know these are students and. They do have a right to be protected. The other side of that argument is, you know, if a crime has been committed, especially something like rape, you know, certainly this seems like they're using FERPA to protect their students, not necessarily for the reasons. The argument is that it goes against the spirit of FERPA, I guess.
Doesn't the lawsuit also kind of go after administrators? For how they handled the situation?
It does. I mean, that's part of the lawsuit itself. Yeah, is that, you know, and without naming, you know, the particulars, certainly President Mearns is always at the heart of everything because he's the president of the university, but there are others, you know, the police chief and others, and there are concerns that...
There's since been a new police chief hired,
right,
correct?
Right. And, you know, it's... we've had a hard time finding a paper trail on this case. You know, you would think if there was a crime alleged, there would be a report. We haven't been able to find one. They sent us to a website that supposedly logs every police report, and we couldn't identify it. We couldn't identify this particular case. So I think that's part of the argument is, you know, when this happens, it seems like there should be a procedure, and there should be some, you know, even if you redact names or whatever, you need to find out what, especially on campus, you need to find out what happened. There was some other incidents off campus recently as well with similar concerns. One had to do with some student athletes in Newport and an alleged assault there, and there was no charge filed. And when we talked to the people involved, they said it was because the student involved, the female student, chose not to file charges. They said her argument seemed credible. It certainly seemed there was enough, you know, evidence to file charges. There were several witnesses. And because she chose not to go, you know, it's really hard to prosecute a case or even bring a case when the alleged victim doesn't want to step forward. So
I think the Inquirer is also objecting
That's right.
as well. But I think in the Tribune's case, what you're saying is that there's highest public interest and concern about this because this involves a public institution.
And, you know, it's not to pick on NKU because in a lot of ways NKU has a pretty good record with regard to this. You know, nationally, you know, you look at them and they will point to their statistics that have them. You know, among the higher ranked with regard to these types of incidents. But nationally, you know, it's all across the news. Certainly Baylor University has seen their issues with these types of things. And there's a large concern about protecting students on campus and, in a lot of cases, athletes getting preferential treatment. So I think, you know, it's a case where, you know, as reporters, we want to know everything that we can, and we feel like the public has a right to know everything that they can, and Northern Kentucky University and every institution wants to be sure that they're protecting all of their students, you know, not just an alleged victim, but, you know, certainly any person who's, you know, connected to an incident like this as an aggressor, it's going to carry, no matter what happens, it's going to carry them around for life. So I can certainly see where you know, you do want to protect your students.
Now, this is in front of Judge William Bertelsmann. Is that?
That's correct.
And when's he going to hear the?
I think it's the 18th. I'm almost sure it's the 18th. Another reporter has been taking the lead on this. So, but yeah, I'm almost positive. It's October 18th at 1 p.m. I have it right here. So barring some, you know,
Some unforeseen development
between now and then or an extension or something, we'll know very soon.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining me now as we review the news of the week from Northern Kentucky, Northern Kentucky Tribune Managing Editor Mark Hansel, and WCPO.com reporter Pat LaFleur. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mark, first responders in Boone, Campbell, and Kenton County will be getting an upgrade on their radio system now. What's the need for this new system?
Well, what it amounts to is for years, going back probably to the 60s and 70s, first responders have used UHF and VHF. Police uses one, fire uses the other, and they're not compatible. So in an emergency, they can't communicate with each other. A good example was the tornado in Piner, where these guys are all responding to the same incident, maybe yards away from each other, and unless they're within shouting distance, they can't communicate. The new system, which is going to go to a trunk system, will basically, as long as they're all on the same frequency, and this is true not just within a county or within a city. This would be probably very soon within the region because Indiana and Ohio are going to go to the same thing. They'll all be able to communicate with each other. And, you know, obviously as, you know, with terrorism a threat everywhere, with certainly natural disasters as they're seeing in Florida right now, you could bring in public works and other agencies as well, and everybody will be able to communicate. You'll also have more people with access to these lines of communication. So it's really a remarkable and long overdue change. Just some technology in recent years has allowed it to become as compatible as it is. Boone, Kenton, and Campbell County reacted very quickly on this, and they agreed to do it all together at a cost of about – Kenton took the lead. They were looking at something while Boone and Campbell were looking at something a little bit different independently, and they all agreed within a couple months that this was the way to go. It's going to cost about $30 million, about $10 million for each county, which will be divided among the agencies within the county that use the system, but basically it's $10 million for each county. Upgrading the UHF-VA system that they're using now would have cost almost the same, but it would not have solved that interoperability problem. They would still wouldn't have been able to communicate among departments. So.
And this new system is called a trunk system?
Trunking, yeah. And it uses a different kind of communication. Trying to think of a comparison, and they gave some very good.
You always have to hear the comparison between analog and digital.
Right, it's
the digital. Two different. Yeah. Okay, so this is a digital system that they're going to.
And, a lot of the cost is going to be to, they're going to have to put towers up and things like that. Fortunately, in some, most of the towers, especially along the borders, they'll be able to use each other's equipment. Probably half for each county is going to go towards the actual, like handheld devices and things like that that they use. And that could vary a little bit depending on how much you want to spend, what models you want to use. The good news is that there are several vendors, and they had a seminar when they did this meeting that they allowed them all to look at all the different vendors. And there's some cost variances, and maybe one county won't want Public Works to have as much equipment, just as an example, not to say that anybody's identified that. But figuring everybody's going to use about the same thing, and $30 million is probably a fair price tag.
You're talking about UHF and VHF, and then you're talking about technology that dates back decades and decades and decades. I'm really surprised, Mark, that it's taken this long to get around to saying, here it is 2016, we need to do an upgrade on the system.
Well, I think people have known that they needed the upgrade for a long time. I think part of it is just that the technology has finally gotten to the point where it becomes more practical because of the interoperability, because you cannot just upgrade your own system. But they were to the point where they were actually stealing parts from, outdated models to put other parts together, and finally,
So they're cobbling things together to keep them running?
And a lot of the parts aren't available anymore, so they're looking at, we're going to be, like that bridge. We're going to be functionally obsolete. let's not start talking about
the bridge.
That's right. That's right.
But it's interesting that now for people who live in Boone, Campbell, Kenton counties, what's this mean for them? Do they grasp? You think what the significance of this?
I don't think they will right now. I think probably the people in Pioneer do, because.
They saw what happened.
There were a lot of communication issues there and a lot of problems. And certainly the first responders have been taking the lead on this. They're the ones who have been saying, look, I got a fire truck down the street. I can't talk to it. I need a public works guy to come get a tree out of the road. I can't call him. Now it's just a matter of and even say you're in Petersburg or somewhere in southern Boone County and the closest available response is in Indiana. And in an emergency, those borderlines tend to go away a little bit. You could have somebody come over from Lawrenceburg, and help you in a crisis. So I think people won't realize it on a day-to-day basis.
But they'll realize it when they see improved responses and better service as a result of this.
And the important thing, and all three judges executive would kill me if I didn't mention this, is the 911 communication centers are not going to be merged. They're all – if you – have a Kenton County 911 operator.
Okay, so they'll stay independent.
So they will stay independent. Their ability to communicate across platforms will greatly improve. But if you're in Kenton County, you call 911, you'll get Kenton County dispatch and that sort of thing.
And real quickly, Mark, what's the time frame for getting this new system in place?
And I had this, and it's in my story. I wish I'd printed a copy.
Like 2 years from now?
I want to say 2018. Yeah.
Mark, thanks very much for joining us. Pat, thank you for having me. Northern Kentucky Tribune Managing Editor Mark Hansel and WCPO.com reporter Pat LaFleur. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 30-40% of our food supply becomes waste and ends up in landfills. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll learn about efforts to reduce food waste. We'll also hear how incorporating arts, culture, and historic buildings in community planning promotes urban vitality. And in Focus on Technology, Ohio's newest canine can find everything electronic that criminals try to hide. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.